All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Now, this is coming to you at a critical moment in history. The COVID-19 pandemic is now killing 3,000 people a day just in the U.S., a loss that is almost impossible to grasp. At the back end of the show, we'll hear remarks from Chrissy Stroop, writer, scholar, ex-evangelical, co-editor of Empty the Pews, Stories of Leaving the Church. Now, she participated in a Refuse Fascism forum on why did 74 million people vote for Trump? What is the danger and what do we do about it? She'll be talking about the role of white evangelical Christians in Trump's fascist base. A full 40% of those 74 million Trump voters were white evangelicals. And although a majority of white Christians of all branches of Christianity voted for Trump, none had the numbers and impacts of white evangelicals. Before that, we'll hear the latest from Andy Z, co-initiator of Refuse Fascism and host of the Revolution Nothing Less show on YouTube. Now, he's going to be talking about why did 74 million people vote for Trump? What's the danger and what do we do about it? And opening the show up, I'll share a conversation I had recently with playwright Larry Powell about his new play, The Gaze. All right, I want to introduce our first guest today. His name is Larry Powell. He's the author, creator, and adapter of this play that we're going to be talking about. It's called The Gaze, No Homo, and he's adapted it into a media series, a 12-part series, which you can gain access to by going to the Fountain Theater's Fountain Stream digital platform. And it's presenting Larry's play right now. It's a 12-part series called The Gaze, No Homo, and it's tackling systemic racism and homophobia head on. So really, check this out. And I'm sure you're going to find it very, very interesting and compelling in terms of making you think a whole lot about what the hell is going on in this world. All right. So check that out. All right. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my first guest this week. And he's I think he's a remarkable playwright. And he had me laughing. He had me saying, what the hell? And then finding out that I was laughing at things that I shouldn't have been laughing at, but then just really taken in by his work. And it's just an incredible piece. And it's called, am I right here now? It's called No Homo.
Yes, it's the first play in a cycle of plays called The Gaze. And so it's called The Gaze, No Homo.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's jump, and I do have to say, I mean, it's really something. I started reading it last night and Lucy had sent it to me earlier. And I thought, okay, well, just, sit in it for a while at the night, like I usually do. And I have a way to actually figure out what's going on. But I really, really, really enjoyed the play. It was remarkable. And I thought the whole way that it was set up, but I also thought just the way you carried out, the what was going on. So let's start by telling people what the play is.
Well, the play is a piece of me, a piece of my community. It's sort of a version of all the stories that I have been feeling and hearing and a part of in the Black theater community all across America. It's a play about a young actor who is out and who identifies as queer, same gender loving. And he is a newbie at this historically very prestigious white theater festival, a new play theater festival. And he's sort of navigating the microaggressions and the systemic issues at that festival. And so I've had a lot of experience in that. And so this play is just sort of a dark satiric look and examination of Black queer work being developed in these historically white American theater spaces.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that got me too, though, is it's like now it's a 12-part series, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you're reading this and you're listening to it, you're reading it and you're thinking, wow, where is this coming from? And it's very interesting because the whole way it's laid out, you're almost, even though it's like a very different way, I think, for a lot of people when they think they're going to see a play, to see what you have and you have the people speaking as individuals, and they're at the same time, they're all there at the same time in the same level of, I don't know what you'd call it, but it's just people are there in the place with you. And so you're listening to them, you're watching them reactions. And it's much more than just saying, it was a play that was, I just did this to have people talking back and then doing this. But it's actually, first off, I think the title of it, I think this is what you have as a title, right? That you adapted this play, then it's The Gaze, No Homo, and you adapted it into a media series, and it's a 12-part series. Let's tell people about that, why you did that to start off, okay?
Yeah, well, you know, the Gaze, it's the Gaze, G-A-Z-E. And of course, that's a sort of play on words, because I am also talking about being a gay actor and a black actor in a theater scene. And but we're also talking about the white gaze and operating under the white male cis hetero gaze, of, like, you know, the people who are calling the shots usually, or on the boards, or even in the audiences, or directing the plays. And it was just really, really important for me to be able to speak up this summer, this year. You know, I was also on the front lines, as I've always been, but I really, this year, I was really, really took it up a notch being on the front lines for the fights for social justice and equity and equality. You know, when George Floyd happened, and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and so many others who we don't even know the names of, all of my trans sisters as well, like, I knew that I had a piece of artivism, you know, art that was also functioning as activism, which I think all great art actually just is inherently. And there was a moment where I saw a quote from Toni Morrison, I do believe. And Toni was saying, you know, this is the time artists go to work. You know, this is the time where artists go to work. When the theaters shut down, this is when the time where the playwright said, well, how do I get my story told? So I just really found a way to get my story told. I knew that people had devices. I knew that we had cameras at home. We have iPhones. We have whatever, Androids. We have laptops and all types of things. And there could be a way for us to figure out how to tell the story. But for me, because I'm Larry Powell, it has to be in a dope kind of way.
There you go.
It can't just be people coming on and reading my play on Zoom. Because for me, I was already doing that. And there was something about that that was just not, that wasn't just, it wasn't hitting the mark for me. It just wasn't cool enough for me. And so I knew that people were sitting at home, and I know that people like to watch things in doses. And so I just took my play scene by scene, and I adapted it into this medium. And so I call it a digiplay too, because you can watch it all at once as well. You know, people call that binging, or I actually have a digiplay format with an act one and an act two with an intermission, 1 minute intermission in the middle. So you can sit and watch it. It comes out to about 2.5 hours.
Yeah, you know, I watched the whole thing once, and then I watched it in sections right before we did this interview. And I was, you know, because I was thinking about it. It's like there's a lot that's there that you don't really see concentrated in such a way. Just be in society in general, and in the theater world as well, in any arts world, you don't see a lot of things that you actually pressed there that I thought were very important. And you know, the whole idea that, you know, your character, it's like, you know, this person who you're watching him, and he's at this, you know, at this sort of this coming together of people who are trying to figure out how to, you know, present this certain thing that's going on. And they're practicing, I guess it's a, you know, practice for a play that's coming up. And he's actually trying to figure out, okay, what is it? And he keeps coming up against and opposing a lot of the people, not, you know, not in a way that he's like saying, oh, shut up or something, but he's actually doing his thing in a way that is causing some trouble in the group overall. But he's wrestling with, well, what the hell are these guys talking about? What are they saying? What are they actually, you know, what is it? How come I'm not seeing what they see? And how come they're not seeing what I see? And there's something that has to actually be played out there. And I thought you did a very good job imposing that all the way through.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, you really get it. You really got it. I'm really happy to talk with you. I'm going to pause for a second. It's really hard for me to hear you. I'm using my psychic skills to really hear you.
But okay.
Literally, it sounds like you're in the Matrix. Like, so I'm being a bit of Neo here, you know, using my my skills. But I will respond while I guess you're addressing that. Yeah, it is important to me that I was able to not only talk about the problem from the other side, not only talk about, you know, the character of Miranda Cryer in my piece. You know, yes, there is always that Miranda Cryer, and a lot of times Miranda Cryers aren't even white women. You know, the Miranda Cryers in my life sometimes have been other brothers, other or a black, you know, it's just this notion of supremacy, of I'm the one that knows more than you, that I think can get in the way of education, gets in the way of even in the activism streets, you know, in certain grassroots organizations. You know, it's our egos and our you know, what Martin Luther King talks about, the drum major instinct. Like, you know, I have to be the one that I have to be the one that goes first, and I have to be the one that knows. And so I think that Jerome is not perfect either in that. Jerome also, it was important for me that I also implicated Jerome. Like, you know what I mean? It was important for me that I also was like, well, what is Jerome doing wrong? Jerome is the protagonist in my piece. And though he is struggling and feeling misunderstood, and very much so is being misunderstood, but there are some times where he is misunderstanding the others in the room and in the space. And so I tried to find a way to make it so that, you know, if you look closely, you'll see that no one is right and no one is wrong in this space at all times. You know, everyone is trying to figure it out. And I think that if I'm successful here, that I'm understanding, or that the audience is like grappling with, well, do we need to continue in this way? What do we need to fix? If I'm successful, the audience is left with like a sort of burning desire to examine the moments of where they have felt those ways, like Jerome is feeling or other characters are feeling in the piece.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that struck me too is that, you know, again, you're dealing with a very serious topic and you're doing it in a way that actually is funny a lot of times. But then even as you're listening, and it's revealing at the same time, but you're listening to this, and even when it's funny, you're sort of sitting back and saying, wait a minute, this is okay, it's funny, but it's not funny. You know, and there's a lot of things that are actually said in that I thought were very, very important. And you said that in order to properly experience your own exodus of the decentralization of the white gaze in your creative work and reclaim your black imagination, this play, developing this play, actually had a lot to do with your ability to do that. I thought that was an important insight, you know, that you were laying bare for people.
That is what I continue to be wowed by, you know. Like, that's what I'm talking about with Jerome's journey specifically. Jerome has been centering the white gaze, and I was centering the white gaze in my life and my work. You know, I went to a school called Oakwood School, which I'm thankful for. I'm not throwing it all away as I discover this in myself. It's not like I'm throwing it all away either. I have to be clear about that, but it's just that it's like, wow, like I really like, there's a time in my life where I was like, white is right. Even me being from a family that is so, you know, I come from Black Panthers. I come from all types of things, like, you know, black preachers, black, it's even that, like the strength of being in the belly of the beast in a way, and sort of, and be at such a young age, you know, not knowing the difference between the owning of my own imagination and where I come from and doing it for them. You know, it's a really kind of confusing space to be at. And I just knew that I couldn't continue to work. I couldn't continue to breathe and live as an artist until I really addressed it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's very important. We're running up out of on our time, but I have a couple of things I wanted to ask you. You know, you talked about your own exodus of the decentralization of the white gaze in your creative work, and you're talking about that now in terms of the reclaiming of black imagination. And I thought it was really interesting that No Homo is the first of your gaze plays, which is what I read, and I thought that was really interesting in that it examines the process of building a culturally specific and queer work of color in certain historically white spaces. And they do it in a way that's not, you know, that's not, it's in a very interesting way because it actually, in the play itself, it confronts people with all the things that they think they're so cool on, but they're not, you know, and people trying to figure out what's going on. And even, you know, and I won't give away anything in it, but there's, you know, there's a thing that happens where someone who is there and is part of the whole scene and has really, you know, been working with all these people for a while, and you present something, your character presents something to him that just blows his mind. And I thought that was really an important thing in terms of seeing how, you know, people are wrestling with hard topics, and you know, there's the, but at the same time, when they begin to see that the hard topics can be true and need to be dealt with, that opens up a whole new world for some people. And I thought that was a really important part of your play in the way that it comes, that it rolls on and towards the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you really got it there. I mean, you know, one of my favorite mentors taught me a long time ago, we satirize things that we love. And I love the theater community. Like, it's all I've known, really. It's been my life, you know? And so I have to keep laughing because I see the absurdity in us, but it comes from a space of deep love. Like, you know, and how do we rebuild? How do we go forward? How do we take all this poison and turn it into medicine, right? How do we transform, you know, these things that aren't working into things that can serve us and really have us reach our dreams of speaking to the audiences of today and the audiences of tomorrow? Because, you know, theater is a sacred tradition. It is necessary in the illumination of the human spirit, right? But it shifts and it changes. That's why I call this a digiplay. Like, you know, the play is the thing, right? But it went from screenplay to teleplay to digiplay. So let's be a digiplay and see what happens from here. But let's not ignore it. And let's not feel like we're failing because we can't be in our theaters. No, the story is larger than the buildings.
Mm-hmm. Now, we got to wrap this up real soon. But I just have one last question for you, which I think is really, really important. And it's a question. Basically, you pose this, and I think it's really important for people to understand this. You pose, why strain to be free under a gaze fixed on your imprisonment when you're the one holding the key?
Yeah, you know, there is this, I really believe, this sort of comfortability or this addiction to capitalism. I think there's this need to just be comfortable in the way things have gone because it feels like too much work to make something work. It's too much work to make it better and to come together and to resist that whole gatekeeper notion and to actually help each other out and to actually talk to each other as if you're human and actually be in a space where you don't have to prove yourself. If you feel like you got to prove yourself, you need to walk out of that room because you ain't got to do that. And I think that that's the question. Why are you doing that? Why am I staying there? Larry, why am I staying in these rooms? Why am I accepting these jobs when I know this is how they run at this theater or in this place? You know, I know that's how they roll. Why am I taking it? Because I have to eat. Yes, yes. But then, okay, beyond that, because there are food banks. There are other ways to eat. Is this truly the only option to continue to feel as though you have no agency and no respect in your creativity? And I think for me, the answer is no. There is always another way. You go where you feel honored and celebrated, and you work from there because the work is better, and we need the good work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean it.
All right, Larry Powell, thank you very much for your work, and thanks for being on the show today, man.
Thanks, Michael.
All right, talk to you again soon, I hope.
Okay, yeah, of course.
Take care, man. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Larry Powell. Larry is the author of the 12-part play called The Gays No Homo, and it's tackling systemic racism, homophobia, and other elements head-on. Next, we're going to hear the latest from Andy Z, co-initiator of Refuse Fascism and host of the Revolution Nothing Less show on YouTube. Now, he's going to be talking about why did 74 million people vote for Trump? What is the danger and what do we do about it?
Why did 74 million people vote for an open racist, toxic male supremacist, anti-Semitic, stunted person lacking any capacity for empathy who caged and separated children from their parents without remorse, a pathological liar and narcissist who consistently and brazenly opposes science and rational thought at the cost of 300,000 lives, disproportionately people of color? Why did 74 million vote to re-elect such a person to lead through a Catholic and evangelical Christian fascist movement, a pandemic, a resulting economic crisis, an existential ecological crisis backed by enormous scientific evidence of climate change imperiling the earth, with hundreds of millions of people besieged every day by catastrophic storm, fire, drought, leading to mass migrations and to the extinction of many species, including threatening our own? Why did 74 million people vote for a regime that is packed with Christian fascists who care nothing for the future because they believe in end times where only they will be raptured to heaven? Biblical literalists, theocrats, whose core beliefs demand the subordination of women and the demonization, if not the elimination, of differently gendered people. Why indeed would 74 million people wave their MAGA flags and vote for a demonstrably psychopathic leader who said, if we have nuclear weapons, why can't we use them and vote to keep his finger on the nuclear trigger, a vengeful bully who reportedly 2 weeks ago had to be talked out of attacking Iran, at least for now? And why would 74 million people vote for someone who repeatedly showed themselves in the wake of the murder of George Floyd to be a vicious, white, supremacist, and genocidal racist? The simple and basic answer is because they agree with him. Ron Reagan, the liberal son of President Reagan, whose presidency began this reactionary momentum that has built over the past 40 years towards the fascist regime of Trump and Pence, said that people follow Trump because he hates the same people that they do. I hear the objection. All 74 million people are racist? Sure, there are those who say they're not. Trump even says that he's the least racist person. Bullshit. To vote for Trump means that you're not just okay with, but you're willing to support, to collaborate with, and put in power for a second term a vengeful, open racist. You knowingly collaborate with concentration camps and a genocidal program against immigrants and refugees, and that's not the tenth of it. It doesn't fucking matter if people say their reason for voting for Trump is because they think he is good for their money, or they identify with his outrageously sticking it to the elites. Plenty of good Germans in the 1930s, including liberals and progressives, thought they could ignore the ugly parts of Hitler and use him to get the policies they wanted. They were not just wrong, but they, in effect, became Nazis at the horrific cost of the tens of millions of lives. But look, to answer the questions of why and what do we do about the 74 million, we must go deeper and pull the historical lens back and apply a scientific method and approach to the underlying structures and dynamics that have given rise to what aspires to be a second coming of the Confederacy. And I'm going to be drawing a lot of this analysis from the work of the revolutionary thinker and leader, Bob Avakian, BA, who has done some deep scientific study of the development of this American fascism as part of analyzing the necessity, the basis, and the strategy for an actual revolution to overthrow the capitalist imperialist system that has white supremacy and patriarchy woven into its fabric to bring it to being a new socialist republic in North America, a radically different and far better system to put humanity on the road to real emancipation. That's why I follow Bob Avakian, and that's why you should too. Donald Trump did not create these divisions. The oppression of black people began with the first slave ship to the U.S. shore in 1619. Slavery was written into the U.S. Constitution. It took on new horrors with the betrayal and reversal of Reconstruction, with its violent apartheid that permeated every sphere of black people's lives under Jim Crow and has continued in new forms with a viciousness that seeps into and permeates every metric of the masses of black people's lives today. Women, from the founding of this country through the Mad Men of the 1950s and much of the 1960s, were kept under the thumb of men with almost no control over their own bodies, their own destinies, even their very lives. And from the theft of the native people's lands down to today, the U.S. has marauded over all over the world, plundering and slaughtering. All of this is the America that Trump wants to go back to make America great again. And since the Civil War, there has been a section of white America, mainly located in the South, but not only, that has created a deadly myth of a lost noble cause, a way of life where people knew their place. Through two world wars and a depression, this myth has persisted, and the oppression of the masses of people continued in new and ever more vicious and perverted forms. Then comes the 1960s. The civil rights movement developed into a powerful black liberation movement, with society shaking uprisings in ghettos of over 200 cities. Radical and revolutionary forces like Malcolm X and the Black Panther Party emerged to shake the foundations of people's thinking and awaken the aspiration towards a radically better and different world. A powerful anti-war movement deeply questioned the whole framework of "we're the good guys" that lies at the heart of American exceptionalism. And responding to all this, and to the profound changes that were taking place in the underlying economy, a youth counterculture arose. Women and gay people then rose up to question the whole foundation of society and of gender itself. One section of the ruling class, represented by the Democrats, adopted a policy of concession and inclusion on the basis of this same capitalist and imperialist oppressive economic system that in all these different forms of oppression were tightly tied into in order to bring a section of these rebelling forces back into the system. Another section of the ruling class, represented by a section of the Republican Party, went to work and built a movement within a section of the fundamentalist Catholic and evangelical churches for over the last 40 years. They said, no, these changes are too much, too destabilizing to cohere this country and to maintain the U.S. empire. And the decades since have accelerated a fast-paced, globalized imperialism, creating a vast network of sweatshops that has moved manufacturing jobs out of the U.S. and or into low-wage areas, hollowing out people's lives and making them susceptible to appeals to fortify their white privilege and regain the status they once had. These are the foot soldiers of both the Christian fascist and militia movements, the shouters who fill the quasi-lynch mob rallies of Donald Trump. This same globalization through which the U.S. exploits people internationally has rendered whole populations of black people, especially the youth, superfluous, condemning them to a life of hustling and mass incarceration and terror at the hands of the police. So too with immigrants, driven from their homelands due to the imperialist destruction of the economies of their countries, along with the first world fueled climate change, has driven billions of people into vast mass shantytown slums and tens of millions into being refugees. Trump has not only amplified all of these pre-existing conditions, this pre-existing oppression, and these sharp divides, but he's normalized this with an unabashed, vicious racism, misogyny, and xenophobia. Trump has cohered a diverse and reactionary fascist movements that predated his regime into a force that has now tasted power and is now embedded in the key institutions, including the courts up to the Supreme Court, and that lives and seethes in its own conspiracy-laden universe of victimization that will propel an aggrieved revanchism. This is a movement that is not going away. There cannot be going back to an imagined past. It's not possible, and it's not desirable. We need to go forward. We need to continue, as Coco said earlier, to be vigilant. And now, with the electoral votes certified for Biden and assuming that the Trump-Pence regime is out of power by January 20th, we need to continue to unite all of those who oppose injustice, continuing to rally all the, quote, decent people to keep this fascist movement on the defensive. But that must not be the end of it. We got to the fascist Trump-Pence regime through the normal workings of this system, and this system is still in effect with a hardened and expanded fascist movement that runs from the highest court through powerful capitalist institutions down to the militias and an organized Christian fascist network of churches. And we will not go forward by putting our hopes and our dreams and work into the delusions of Biden or Bernie. There will be no reaching across the aisle or healing with fascists. Almost every Republican fascist in Congress has refused to even recognize Biden's victory. Overwhelmingly, the Republican fascist base believes the election was stolen, Trump won, and Biden lost. Bob Avakian has made the crucial point that any unity, any reconciliation with these fascists or their program can only be on the terms of the fascists. As for Bernie, or AOC, dreams of reforming capitalism is an illusion and a delusion. A system that functions by maximizing profit through competition among capitalists over who they can exploit more efficiently cannot be made to serve humanity. And just as bad, deciding now for people, just as bad for people to decide now to go back to political sleep, to just get on with your life, ignores the reality that the driving forces of this system will continue to produce the conditions that brought Trump to power in the first place. There is a tremendous struggle to be waged for the future. This is a struggle not just to prevent the return of a fascist regime, but for a radically different and far better world that is not trapped in a system whose very nature sets people against each other, competing just to survive. A system whose functioning continually regenerates the oppressive social relations of white supremacy, xenophobia, misogyny, discrimination against differently gendered people, and all these divisions that torment humanity. And they will continue to fuel a fascist movement. This is not just a struggle with those who rule over this system, whether Democrat or Republican fascist, but it's a struggle amongst ourselves, with everyone who desires a different and better future. A struggle to confront the world as it actually is, to consistently apply a scientific method and approach to all of reality, including society. Over the years of Trump, there's a sense among the people who have opposed the regime that science matters, especially in the midst of the life and death stakes with the COVID pandemic. But a scientific method and approach needs to be applied to the complexity of society and its transformation. It's not okay to just believe those things that make you feel comfortable and ignore those things that discomfort and challenge you. The hour is too late for such an indulgence. And worse, it selfishly ignores the cost to people here and all around the world. There is leadership, extraordinary leadership for this great struggle in Bob Avakian, and his development of the consistently and thoroughly scientific method and approach of the new communism. There is not only the means to understand the world as it actually is, but a pathway to begin to work today to bring forward the people to lead an actual revolution when winning becomes possible. This is a hard road for sure, but there is no future for humanity or for the earth we live on under this system, yet there is in the new communism a way forward to a radically new and better world. So here I make an invitation. And it is also a serious warning for failing to even engage this new development, this new communism, is a choice, and it's a choice that has a cost to the future. You are saying to yourself and to the world, I'm good. What me worry about the earth and the 7 billion who live on it? But as Coco said, the fight against fascism is not over. The Refuse Fascism pledge to the people of the world must continue to resonate far and wide and become not only a needed political and moral compass, but an organized expression of a network ready to act with nonviolent determination to not allow fascism to grow and dominate and terrorize humanity. The next 40 plus days until Trump and Pence are gone from power continue to present real and present danger. Our vigilance matters. So in closing, I want to say to all those who have taken up the call from Refuse Fascism and to my fellow panelists who've exposed the dangers of what we face with these 74 million people voting for this Trump-Pence regime, Our pledge remains, quote, to hold firm to our determination to prevail over a regime that imperils the people of the world and the earth itself. And we closed by saying, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.
That was Andy Z, co-initiator of Refuse Fascism and host of the Revolution Nothing Less show on YouTube, talking about why did 74 million people vote for Trump? What is the danger and what do we do about it? Now, you can see Andy every week on the Revolution Nothing Less show on the YouTube channel, The RevComs. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Now, before we hear from Chrissy Stroop, I'd like to play an important short piece by Bob Avakian, or BA, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the architect of a framework for human emancipation, the New Communism. This is from a talk that BA gave called The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible, and it's called Free Yourself from the GTF.
In confronting and moving to prevent this, one of the biggest obstacles standing in the way and weighing people down is American chauvinism. The disgusting notion that America and Americans are better and more important than everybody else. This is a poison infecting people broadly in this country, even among the bitterly oppressed. And there is a great need for people to break with this American chauvinism. Free yourself from the GTF. The great tautological fallacy. A fallacy, an idea or way of thinking that is false, wrong. A tautology, a round in a circle way of reasoning that asserts something and then claims to prove it by merely asserting the same thing again. So the great tautological fallacy to which I am referring is the notion that America is a force for good in the world. And therefore, whatever it does is good, or at least done with good intentions, even if the same thing, when done by other forces, especially by forces opposed to us, is bad, is evil, because America is a force for good in the world. Thus, in the grip of the great tautological fallacy, when one is told by the authorities and government and the media, etc., that North Korea developing a small number of nuclear weapons and a few long-range ballistic missiles poses a grave threat, one does not question. One does not ask why that is a grave threat, while the only country ever to use nuclear weapons, the United States, having thousands of nuclear weapons and the capability to use them anywhere in the world, is somehow not a grave threat.
That was Bob Avakian on Free Yourself from the GTF. You can find the entire film and much more at revcom.us. That's revcom.us. Now let's hear from Chrissy Stroop, writer, scholar, ex-evangelical, co-editor of Empty the Pews, Stories of Leaving the Church.
If you are an ex-evangelical, you're often accused of hyperbole when you describe simply your own upbringing to people who have no direct lived experience of white evangelical or conservative white Christian subculture of what it's like. They simply can't sort of fathom it. And I kind of can relate to what he said about feeling like a spy behind enemy lines in law school as well, simply as someone who grew up in the Christian right. I like to call myself a child of the culture wars. And, now I've essentially switched sides in the culture wars, right? So I learned everything about what their real values are and what they do because I was indoctrinated in it. And I've spent the last several years thinking a lot about the connections between fundamentalist religion and particularly Christianity, which of course has long since been hegemonic in the West. So when we think about, power in Western context, we have to think about Christianity, but we also have to think about whose Christianity. because, you know, white supremacist Christianity that came from Europe and developed in the United States, we have to contrast that with liberation theology constructed by African Americans and Latin Americans and people of color who find a liberationist message in the Bible. So, you know, I grew up with this bad kind of Christianity, toxic authoritarian Christianity. And I've come to conclude in recent years that fundamentalism is can be looked at as fascism in microcosm or on the margins. You have lots of mechanisms of social discipline in play, intense control of a population. So fundamentalist religions construct what scholars have dubbed enclave cultures. So American evangelical subculture, for example, has a lot of its own institutions, its own information ecosystem. I like to say we were doing alternative facts before it was cool, because, you know, I grew up being sent to hard right-wing, mostly white Christian schools. The Christian school that I graduated from in Indianapolis is called Heritage Christian School. And yeah, that's a code word. Mascot is the Eagles. We grew up, you know, very much with Christian nationalism being the norm of our lived experience. In that school, every day, we said three pledges. So not just the pledge to the American flag, which I think is, you know, maybe not necessarily fully fascist, but creepy and fascist-ish enough, right? But then we would also say the pledge to the Christian flag, which ends with Jesus coming to provide, this part's a direct quote, life and liberty for all who believe. So not for all, but for all who believe. It's a directly anti-pluralist pledge. And then we said a pledge to the Bible. So three pledges to start your day off. You know, meanwhile, in school assemblies and also in the classroom, we're being told that liberals are these horrible, godless people out there who are killing babies, and it's our job to stop them. And they start telling you this 5-6 years old. I mean, really, as soon as you're able to listen in a kind of church or school environment. And my entire social world as a small child was people from Christian school and people from church. That was pretty much it. So you're constantly in this environment where everyone is basically the same as you, and you're being told that people outside of that environment are dangerous. They are collectively referred to as something called the world. The world is a bad place. It says in the Bible, a friend of the world is an enemy of God. The world is under Satan's dominion. And so, you know, eventually you need to get out there and try to convert people. Right. But you have to realize that these are outsiders, they're enemies, they are others. And these people include, of course, liberals, they include you know, communists, Marxists. And by the way, you look into the history of the Christian right in the era of the civil rights movement, and you will find many right-wing Christian preachers like Jerry Falwell accusing Martin Luther King of communism. I mean, of course, he was also spied on by the FBI, but, you know, it's part of the Christian right's legacy. You actually kind of look back to the Cold War is where a lot of the current iteration of the Christian right that really crystallized with the moral majority in the 1970s has its roots. And it was not in the early 70s about abortion at all. It was about the religious freedom, to use the term that they continue to weaponize in the courts, to try to actually carve out, you know, legally enshrine religious privilege, but religious freedom to discriminate against African Americans, right? They didn't want to have to admit African Americans to Christian schools and colleges and so forth. That became, of course, more impolitic for white evangelicals who wanted to be regarded as respectable. And many do, by the late 1970s. And so rallying around abortion, which was pretty much the brainchild of Paul Weyrich, working with Jerry Falwell and some others, became a sort of proxy for the white supremacism that the Christian right's voting patterns still uphold today. They, of course, most of them, if you ask them, are you a racist? Are you a white supremacist? They will say no. But you know, a bunch of Southern Baptist seminaries just released a statement denouncing critical race theory as against the Bible. So it's pretty clear where they stand. So you want to talk about these Trump voters and the theocratic aspects of that. You want to talk about it by the numbers. Well, so that 74 million, 40% of them were white evangelicals, white evangelical Protestants who have been through Trump's entire 4 years. And, you know, even before, once he became the candidate in the 2016 primaries, the single most Trumpist demographic in America. White evangelicals are the big outliers on everything, from their views on marriage equality to the Trump regime's Muslim ban. You know, they're simply more conservative, if you want to call it that, more fascist, I suppose I would say, than any other group. And there's a lot of physical abuse and sexual abuse that goes on in these communities, as happens in any kind of authoritarian climate, where certain hierarchies, social hierarchies, are enforced, in this case, white supremacist patriarchy. But there's also a lot of emotional manipulation that goes on in these communities. And again, you are raised on disinformation. So, and accepting that disinformation becomes kind of the calling card of your identity. So if you question any part of it, your loyalty is questioned. If you actually break with your family or this wider, you know, conservative Christian community on any major political issue, I mean, you might lose your entire social support network. At the very least, people will start questioning your salvation, and you know, you'll start to lose social standing in the community. So a lot of people who maybe I would argue that everyone is harmed by this system, but of course the place is white men, white male leaders on top. But a lot of white women are willing to go along, to get along here for proximity to power. And it sometimes can be some of the worst enforcers, particularly of gender norms. And unless there is really something about you, your identity, your personality, that makes you start to question this, I think for most people, it's just easier to stay. Certainly the indoctrination that comes from your earliest years. I mean, I remember as a very small child, I think I was about 4 when my dad prayed through the prayer of salvation with me, you know, and I was told that if I didn't accept Jesus into my heart, I would go to hell. And hell is a literal place where you are tortured and burned forever. It's really scary. And I remember being up some nights crying, thinking, did I do it right? Am I really saved? Am I going to hell? You know, so they start instilling this fear in you from day one, really, of your life, and then telling you that to be safe, you have to do everything that our community says, you know, and don't look too closely at what's going on outside there, because that's from the devil. Your doubts are maybe literally you know, the work of demons infiltrating your mind. You cannot trust yourself. You're basically taught to gaslight yourself. So these are the kind of people that we're dealing with. Now, I have to admit that I, too, was kind of taken in toward the end of the election by a lot of the optimism that was going around in Democratic circles about a big blue wave. And I hoped, at least, that that was going to prove correct. But I'm not so surprised at the end of the day that Trump's raw numbers in terms of the vote are actually higher than they were in 2016, because I've been, you know, I'm someone who helps to monitor the Christian right, and I publish commentary and policy research sometimes for the think tank Political Research Associates, for example. I knew that the Christian right was vowing to step up its ground game, and they've got a hell of a lot of money. You know, to spend on this sort of thing. So it was really a question of who was going to outvote whom in this election with high turnout on both sides. But the Christian right certainly followed through on its ground game. And I think another factor that it's important to consider is that churches have started using third-party apps, literally designed by the same people from Cambridge Analytica and their friends at the Council for National Policy, to micro-target people for potential converts. But then the people who make these apps are very much conscious of how this will be used to mobilize Christians through churches for the political right. We were doing this back in the day you know, with older methods. So my Christian school sent high school juniors and seniors on, I suppose you would call them field trips, but it seems awkward to call them that, to sort of tea party before the tea party type conventions. This group in Indiana was called Citizens Concerned for the Constitution. It has since been rebranded as Advance America, which makes it sound like a payday loan company. But it bills itself on its website as Indiana's premier pro-family, pro-homeschooling, pro-Christian schools organization. So we went to their conventions, we gathered their voter guides, and then on school time, students were, sent out of class to stuff these voter guides basically in envelopes and direct mail them out to people affiliated with our school or on our address list. Well, now they're using digital manipulation through the same thing. You go to a church, you might sign in with a computer, give them information about yourself. You might, register your kids in their computer system so that supposedly for security, so that you make sure you pick them up from Sunday school after the service is over or whatever. But these apps are collecting your data. They're not protecting it. And then it's being gathered and used by Council for National Policy and Republican operatives with the full knowledge of the Christians who create some of these programs that churches use. Some pastors don't necessarily know their churches are being manipulated this way, but it's actually quite a brilliant strategy because these white evangelical churches have always been bastions of white supremacism. And to be sure, majorities of all white Christian demographics voted for Trump. So also a majority of white Catholics, a majority of white mainline Protestants. But again, not in the same numbers as evangelicals, but it is mostly traditionalist Catholics, some mainliners, and then also Mormons who kind of make up the rest of that Christian right base. That Trump has actually shown that he values at least their loyalty throughout his 4 years, because he's pursued the Christian right's agenda of, trying to overturn Roe v. Wade, trying to ban abortion, trying to carve out more and more religious exemptions, trying to take away access to health care and rights for trans and gay individuals. And of course, moving our embassy, the U.S. embassy in Israel, from secular Tel Aviv to Jerusalem with all of its poignant religious symbolism to, all the three major Abrahamic religions. That's been a goal of the Christian right for a long time, or at least of evangelicals, because of their belief that it's necessary for their end times prophecies to play out. Even George W. Bush would never have moved our embassy to Jerusalem, because it's an extremely destabilizing, frankly stupid, foreign policy move. Trump did it because he has been rewarding his most loyal base. And so some of the last things I want to say, before, I suppose my time is probably up, but before I turn it over, is that, we often hear that Trump has duped these poor marks. He's using Christians, he's using evangelicals. How could they support him? This is just entirely the wrong framing. They've been using Trump this entire time more than he's using them. Many of them, know he's a repulsive person and frankly not very smart, though they'll never say it out loud where the public can hear. Some of them don't like him, but they like what he does. They gave him a chance and he literally fulfilled their entire wish list. So just to sort of sum up, I guess I would say that when we talk about fighting fascism, we have to realize that we are dealing with not fake Christianity, or I've heard some commentators say, they say that Trump's main support group is white evangelicals, but I don't think they're really evangelicals. I don't think they go to church. Even according to the data that we have, that just makes no sense. But what it is a reflection of the de facto Christian state of the American public sphere, where mainstream media outlets and many commentators, many liberals simply do not want to countenance that Christianity is not always or inherently benign. It can be liberationist, as in the Black Church, but it can also side with imperial power. The Bible is multivalent enough to serve both of these purposes. And it has been used to uphold imperial power since Roman times, since the time of Constantine. And yet again, if you want to look at the way that this is similar to abusers, narcissists, or a sort of more secular fascism, this kind of Christianity cultivates majoritarian grievance, right? So they're always being persecuted. They're always being treated unfairly. And no, they're not going to go gently into that good night now that Trump has been defeated in this election. In fact, many prominent evangelical voices are insisting that Trump actually won the election, telling the voter fraud lie, pushing all kinds of disinformation. Anti-democratic, anti-pluralist, and in the case of America, you can't separate it from white supremacist Christianity, is a very serious threat to democracy and human rights. Hierarchical institutional churches have, generally tended to uphold fascism. I mean, just look at the Vatican during World War II. And again, this is something that polite people don't like to say, but most of the rank and file Nazis were Christians. We like to associate the Nazis with the occult because I think it helps to other them more and make them seem less like us. Most theologians, Protestant and Catholic, backed Hitler's regime. And most white Christians in America back Trump's regime. We have to face that. And I think that if we want to dismantle this system, then we have to include the Christian supremacism there and embrace pluralism. So not, go all in for, French Revolution style anti-clericalism. Let's not chop the heads off of bishops or anything. And certainly let's not alienate the Black Church or other believers of different confessions who, share values with secular Americans like myself. I'm an atheist at this point because I had quite enough of Christianity growing up the way I did, and then, having to figure out why I always felt different in figuring out that I'm a trans woman. But, what we need is coalitions of secular people and believers around shared values rather than shared beliefs. At the same time, we cannot sidestep that some very large branches of Christianity that we need to understand as such are very harmful to the cause of democracy and human rights.
That was Chrissy Stroop, writer, scholar, ex-evangelical, co-editor of Empty the Pews, Stories of Leaving the Church. You can hear the entire forum at refusefascism.org. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. Write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.